by just reading a few of his words. He said, "There's been a profound shift in the purposes and objectives of marriage over the period of a few decades, and therefore in motivations for marriage. Marriage was once primarily an economic institution, and mates were chosen in considerable part for their ability to make a go of the economic aspects of marriage. Both husband and wife had heavy work roles if the family was to be a success. The family was the unit of survival in a socioeconomic system. The numerous duties performed in the homes and on the farm made the family relationship the primary one in every aspect of life. It is no longer so, and because it is no longer so, marriage has come to be viewed as a means of personal happiness and companionship and not primarily as a means for sustenance or survival. While the domestic skills on the part of the wife and the thrift and industry on the part of the husband are still standards by which successful marriage is sometimes judged, the success or failure of a marriage does not hinge primarily on these factors, but upon the ability of the husband and wife to meet each other's psychological, emotional, and companionship needs." And while I might quibble with a little bit of what he said, I think he does have a valid point, documenting the fact that a shift has taken place in the way people view marriage, a shift that I think is somewhat good and also sometimes not good. Marriage is a multi-billion dollar industry. People spend a lot of money to get married. They spend a lot of money planning to get married. But unfortunately, the marriage repair business is also a multi-million dollar business. I would like to subject to you that we don't have to spend multi-billions of dollars in terms of learning marriage. You can probably spend less than a dollar, and if you don't have a dollar, you can get one free. And this will tell you, I believe, how to have a successful marriage. I don't want to oversimplify it, but I think sometimes we go digging deeper when in actuality there's water closer to the surface than we actually tend to think. Since you are sitting, you may be under the illusion that you are sitting still, but you are not. In fact, you and I are both in very rapid motion, and I'm obviously referring to the Earth's rotation when I say that. In the course of a day, our planet rotates briskly at the rate of 1,000 miles an hour at the equator. Then there's the Earth's orbital rate of rotation. We have to travel approximately 67,000 miles per hour to make it all the way around the sun in a year. I could not be, or I could not feel more stationary than when I'm standing here. But in spite of the fact that I don't feel like I'm moving, I am in fact, as you are, moving very fast. And I see the effects, as you do, every day as the sun rises and sets. Although our failure to recognize how fast we're traveling may not have a great negative ramification on our daily living, failure to recognize other kinds of movement will have graver implications. All too often, this kind of negative and neglect ruins marriages. When two people first fall in love, they may have a hard time imagining that they could ever drift apart. But you and I know that it happens. They assume that if they don't actively violate their marriage vows, then love will continue at the same fervor as when they made those vows. Yet, although two people may not feel themselves moving away from each other, couples who don't take active steps to maintain their relationships and invest in those relationships may wake up one day to find they've drifted apart and they really don't know each other anymore. The cares, Jesus calls them thorns in the parable of the sower in Matthew chapter 13, of life, I believe, will exert an orbital pull on the marriage that must be actively resisted. Passivity equals moving away from each other, swiftly, sometimes slowly, but always steadily. Our expectations when we enter into marriage are varied, and they're largely varied by our exposure to marriage that we've seen in the homes we grew up in, the people in our congregations. Our goal today is to try to help one another with those relationships, and through our examples, if not through our words, but our examples speak louder, help our children and our grandchildren. And some of them are going to be exposed in their classes today about the process of selecting a mate. But the family and the marriage has changed drastically over the last few decades. And many of us, I'm 61, many of us grew up with unrealistic images of the family. We grew up with Ward and June Cleaver, Ozzie and Harriet Nelson, the good old days, Walton's Mountain. Nothing wrong with those shows, but my mother did not wear high heels and earrings to supper every night. I cannot remember my mother ever wearing high heels and earrings to supper. But those images do exert a little subtle pressure upon us so that when we got married, some of us kind of expected things to be maybe a little different than they were. I think I mentioned Monday, and I like this line, after the honeymoon comes the marriage. And what that means is after that lusty fervor, then comes daily living. Well, I personally, and maybe this is an age comment, I like the daily living more than I like the lustful feeling, but it does last longer, and we come back to earth. Someone said it's a lot easier to be married with someone than it is to live with someone. But it does sometimes lead us to false expectations, which I think, and we'll talk later about, is one of the troubles that sometimes besets a marriage. I do not believe there is such a thing as a perfect marriage, unless we go back to my class Monday and talk about the bridegroom and bride, and that can be a perfect marriage. But I do not have a perfect marriage, and if you're married, you do not have a perfect marriage, and if you get married, you will not have a perfect marriage because you and your mate are not perfect. And you cannot take two imperfects, put them together, and end up with a perfect. It's kind of ironic. We take two sinners and tell them to live under the same roof and live happily ever after. That is a bit of a misnomer. It's a wonderful goal, and I know many of you have spent 99.9% of your times happy. But there are times when maybe it doesn't seem happy. I don't think it's necessarily wrong, or maybe not even unusual, to view marriage a little bit as a corral. It's all right to fight, and it's already all right to kick in the corral, but don't ever jump the fence. You stay in the corral, you stay in the marriage. Now, all of us prefer good news to bad news. We like frowns better than smiles. We like laughter better than tears. And we prefer encouragement over criticism. But I also prefer the truth to fantasy. And the truth is, sadly, the American family is somewhere between somber and tragic. I do not feel that way about the families in the church, although sometimes that does happen. And we're not immune to the cultural pulls and the human pulls. And the effect, it affects all of us. I doubt there is a family represented here today that has not directly or indirectly been touched by a broken home, a broken marriage, very closely. There's not a family that's immune to that. So if you're touched by that, all I can say is not welcome to the club, but we're in this boat together. But we live in a narcissistic society, one in which I want replaces I will. My rights have replaced my responsibilities. Myself has replaced others. And desire has taken the place of commitment. And that is a recipe for disaster when it comes to the home and when it comes to the marriage. In Ephesians chapter 6, it's interesting that the first four or five verses there talk about family relationships and parents and children, and I think Tom covered that relationship earlier this week. But right after that, when we drop down to verses 9, 10, and following, we get a very insight into Satan and his warfare. I don't think that is a juxtaposed accident. I believe Satan's attack point is primarily the home, because Satan knows that if he can destroy the home and our marriages, he will destroy our nation, and he will, I almost said destroy the church, and I would say destroy the church, except the Bible says the church will still be here when Christ comes, but he can greatly damage the church. Most of you know, in looking at your own home congregations, one of the more difficult tasks you have are finding men who can be qualified to lead. And one of the great hindrances in finding men today qualified to lead is the marriage and family issue. I wish it were not so. But it is so. I know many men that in my wisdom, which is not God's wisdom, I would say, boy, they would make wonderful leaders in the church. But when we go to various aspects of their lives, maybe a long time past, the family becomes an issue. It becomes an issue. We live in a society where living together takes the place of marriage. I remember talking, and I don't think he'll mind me mentioning this, to Tad Morris, and many of you know Tad. He got married 6 months ago, and he works in a hospital setting, so he works with a lot of ladies or women, and there is a difference. And it was interesting, he couldn't find that he hardly worked with a lady that wasn't living with someone that she wasn't married to. And so they didn't understand how Tad and Joanne were going to get married before they lived together. In fact, he told me one lady thought Tad was so conservative that after he got married, she asked him if they had moved in together. And Tad, he just shook his head. But she said, well, you're so conservative, I thought maybe you had to wait 3 months after you got married before you lived together. Well, I don't think that's what the Bible asks us to do. But it's very telling about the mindset. If you've been married for more than 10 years, people are going to look at you as, wow. And if you've been married for more than 30 years, they're probably going to think you're just brain dead. And it just doesn't work. Well, we're not used to that. You know, we see lots of 50, 60, 70-year-old marriages. And I think that's wonderful. I don't personally think longevity is the test of a good marriage. It may simply be the test of tolerance. But good marriages should have longevity, so it should be the result of a good marriage. Okay, that's probably enough on that. Let's go back and spend just a few minutes on the very basics, and then I want to go and dissect, maybe in a way I really hadn't looked at it, Ephesians chapter 5. But before we do that, let's go back and just lay a few basics for the sake of everybody in the tape. When it comes down to it, relationships are really all that we have that last. My house, my car, this camp, all of that's going to go. But what I do have and what you do have, I hope, are relationships with God, with our brothers and sisters, and with our families. And those can last. I believe they can last here on earth, and I believe they can last in heaven. God has given us three great institutions. He's given us the government to protect our lives, the church to protect our souls, and our marriages to protect our families. And it's interesting to note, which one of those three did he give us first? He gave us marriage and the family, Genesis chapter 2, because God knows that the governments and the church depends upon us having strong families. They are not more important than those other two institutions, but they are preliminary to those other two institutions. We do not live in a society that is highly polygamous today, but we do live in a society that is highly serial monogamous. The difference is polygamy has multiple mates at the same time. Serial monogamy has multiple mates over the course of a life. I'm not sure that that is any better. In fact, I might conclude that it is not as good. But it is certainly one of Satan's great attack points. Great in not terms of good, but great in terms of effective. We're told in Luke chapter 14 that only a fool would start to build a building or engage in a battle without first counting the cost. Well, it always has amazed me how many times people do begin on what is one of their most, probably their second most important adventure, their marriages, without really counting the cost. We have two people with two different ideas of what a marriage and a family should be. They start at different ends, and they start to build their homes, their families, and they wonder why when they get to the middle it doesn't match up. Well, when that happens, it's usually because they're working from two different sets of blueprints. Now, all of us bring different blueprints to our marriages in terms of what we think our marriages should be based upon what we have seen. However, this is the master blueprint. And I believe God has told us and has given us for over 2,000 years everything I need to have a successful home, to be a successful husband, to have a successful family, and for you ladies to be successful wives. Now in Genesis chapters 1 and 2, we have given to us several basic premises of marriage. Number one, marriage is for procreation. Genesis chapter 1, verse 28, be fruitful and multiply, which is probably the only commandment God has given us that we have consistently kept. Number two, when we move to the latter part of the second chapter, it says that a man and a wife should cleave unto one another. There is a permanency of marriage. The word cleave there means to glue, to remain intact. And Jesus says in Mark chapter 10, verse 9, what God has joined together, let no man put asunder. That is a command, not an option. The Lord does not ask us to say, how can we get out of it? He asks us to look at it from how can I make it better and how can I make it work. Marriage is not a disposable institution. It is to be a growing relationship. Margaret Mead, she's now dead, but in the 1960s was a sociologist, once said, and I always like this quote, the number one problem with marriage is that people enter into it with the feeling that it is terminable. And if anybody enters into a marriage thinking that if it doesn't work, you can just get out of it, then you're probably in big trouble. There was a lady that was at the camp out this year. I'm not sure that she's still with us. I won't mention her name, but she was engaged to a young man at one time. And they were beginning to have second thoughts. And one night he said, well, if it doesn't work, we can always get a divorce. Well, she wisely gave him back his ring, and is now married to a good Christian man. Because when you approach it that way, you're over halfway there. There's probably, in the honesty of your hearts, not a married person here in the sound of my voice that on a given day couldn't have been tempted to just chuck it. But we don't. It's called commitment. When the thought of leaving enters a marriage, it develops a crack that widens, and if not repaired, will go on and cause a crumbling. Unfortunately, many heed the words of Douglas MacArthur. He said, don't consider marriage until you've mastered the art of warfare. Well, I'm not sure that's a good approach to marriage either. In Proverbs chapter 24, verses 3 and 4, it says, marriage is built on wisdom and understanding. And I quote, through wisdom is a house built, and by understanding is it established, and by knowledge shall the chambers be filled with all precious ointments. Okay, I've got some other introductory comments, but I can save them for the end. I want to now move to make sure I have time to spend some time with you looking at Ephesians chapter 5. And please don't dial us out as this is so pedantic, because I know that you have probably all read Ephesians chapter 5 verses 21 and following multiple times. Mike Mason, in a book entitled The Mystery of Marriage, describes marriage as an adventure in selflessness. And that's what I'd like to spend some time. I do not believe a good marriage is difficult, and I don't believe it's hard to understand what to do. Now, please, I'm not underestimating how trying we can be on one another, but I believe we as a society have made this topic a lot more complicated than it really is, and maybe that's so people can sell books to tell us how to do it. I want to read this paragraph from Mike Mason's book. I quote, marriage is a relationship far more engrossing than we want it to be. It always turns out to be more we bargain for. It is a disturbingly intense, disruptively involvement that is exactly the way it was designed to be. It is supposed to be more, almost more than we can handle. It was meant to be a lifelong encounter that would be more rigorous and demanding than anything human beings could ever have chosen, dreamed of, desired, or invented on their own. Only marriage, he said, urges us into those deep and unknown waters, for that is the very purpose, to get us out beyond our depth, out of the shallows of our own secure egocentricity, and into the dangerous, unpredictable depths of a real interpersonal encounter, end quote. As I said Monday, for the bride of Christ, spiritually, to be all that God wants it and created it to be, the bride has to focus on the desires of the bridegroom, not her own goals. Now, I'm not saying by that the secret to a marriage is the wife simply focusing on her husband's desires, because in the bridegroom-bride analogy, we are all the brides, aren't we? So the bride, that's all of us, has to focus on somebody else's desires in order to have the spiritual relationship that God wants us to have. Well, I believe that is also true in our marriages. The greater the surrender, the more exhilarating the journey, and the richer the relationship. And I don't think that's ever truer than in a marriage here on earth, except possibly in our marriage to the Lord. With that, I'm going to turn now, and if you care to join me, we're going to turn to Ephesians chapter 5 and look at verses that I know we have looked at, but maybe pull a few things out or look at them from a little different angle. I believe I can sum up what the Lord tells me about what is important to having, being a good husband and having a good marriage, in three words: God, love, and respect. And if you and I can keep those three words in mind, and the rest of this section is going to be about those three words, I think we can have good marriages. Now, I understand that it takes two to tango, and you can do all of those three, and if somebody else doesn't, it can be difficult. I don't know how you stay married to somebody that doesn't want to stay married to you. I've never had to face that. I do understand that. So as I go through this, if you've had difficulties, do not take it that I'm automatically saying you blew it. It does take two to tango, but I do think these are the principles with which we need to look at. And the verse that often stands out, at least for the women, is verse 25. Husbands, love your wives, even as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for it. And that's a good verse. And the verse that often stands out for the husband is the one that comments on the wife being subject or submissive to the husband. And that is a good verse. If it wasn't a good verse, it wouldn't be in there. But let's take a little broader and maybe a little deeper look at it. There are numerous passages where man is commanded to love his wife. There are not numerous passages in Scripture where the woman is commanded to love her husband. I once made the statement that there is no passage in the New Testament where women are commanded to love their husbands. And one good Bible student lady in the audience pointed me to Titus chapter 2, verse 4, where Paul asked Timothy to have the older women teach the youngers to love their husbands. But I still stand by my statement in this context. I have not found any passage in the New Testament where women are commanded to agape love their husbands. The word for love in Titus chapter 2, verse 4 is philia, which is more of a friendship, family type of love. Now, does that mean God does not want women to agape love their husbands? No, I don't think that is what that means. What I take out of this is, God has created you ladies so that you will more naturally, agape, spiritually in its greatest depth, love us men. We men are not created so that it is as natural for us to do that, so God saw fit to command us to do that. There are many books and many lectures that talk about women loving their husbands. Well, I hope you all do. But in the same sense, it is not commanded, or with the same intensity, it is not commanded in the Bibles, because men and women are different. Generally, women love to love. Women love puppies, they love kittens, and they love babies. Now, I'm not going to say men don't love puppies, kittens, and babies, but when a new baby shows up, you don't usually see six men standing around go, ooh. I need Tom Woody to do that. He does that better than I do. But you'll find all kinds of women doing it. A guy will look at a dog, and maybe he likes it, but his thought is, that thing's not big enough to tree a coon. Women just love them. Now, there are exceptions to that. And not all women naturally love, because some women leave their husbands. And that's not a loving thing to do. So I am talking in general. Men, however, I don't think naturally love in the same way that women do. And men, therefore, need that divine command. And women are seeking agape love. They're seeking the love of a man who would willingly give his life for his mate. My wife is sitting here, and I had this in my notes even when I wasn't sure she was going to be here, but it hasn't been. It was a couple of weeks ago I told Donna, I would be willing to go to the moon for you. Well, she asked me when. So, like I said, we're in this boat together, guys. The worst thing in our marriage is that I've rubbed off on her a little bit. But I'm still here. You ask 100 women, what's the most important thing about marriage? And most of them will say communication. You ask 100 men, what's the most important thing about marriage? And many of them will say communication. But that's because they've been brainwashed. That is not their automatic natural tendency. It's not their natural inclination. For women, they think in terms of how can you commune if you don't communicate? Therefore, a woman would want to talk about problems frequently and daily to keep them from becoming major problems. And I don't have any argument about that. There's a lot of logical reasoning behind that. But men might tend to look at that and say, if we're talking about it all the time, we must have a problem. See, a woman wants to talk about it to keep it from being a problem. A man, when you talk about it too much, he just assumes it's already a problem. You know, a guy goes to work for 8 hours. Maybe he's got a 30-minute commute. So he's gone from home with lunch break, 10 hours. How many men driving home after that say, what I need to do is sit down and talk to my wife for 2 hours? Now, come on, guys. But that may be what she needs. So now we're into listening and communication. And I don't mean to be flippant about that, but we are funny. We are funny people. When I'm gone, and I'm gone frequently, I may be gone for a week or two, and I get home, and I know how you feel. You know, I don't know how tired I am, but I am tired, and Donna wants to catch up. So we found that if we do that each night on the phone, it works a lot better because I'm just exhausted when I get home, and she's not had someone there. Academically, one of the terms they give to you ladies, and some of us men, but primarily to ladies, is a term called expressive responsive. And what that means is that when something is on a woman's mind, it usually shows up on her face. She usually expresses kind of what she's feeling. That's why some studies indicate women tend to wrinkle more than men. And that's not bad. It's because you ladies tend to laugh and cry more than sometimes we men do. Men tend to suppress their inward expression. Sometimes that's called compartmentalizing. And that has some very valid strengths to it. But it is an important difference. There are strengths and weaknesses in both. It's that suppressing and that compartmentalizing that allows the warrior in men to compartmentalize and go to their death in battle. And it's a strength. You know, they'll just put everything aside and they'll go sometimes to their death, defending their country or defending their family. But men can also put emotions under wraps so that their wives don't know what's going on. And when that happens, it becomes a weakness. One writer, and I don't totally like all of this phrase, but I wrote it down, said it's kind of like we've got poker face and crybaby. I don't like the crybaby part because that makes the woman sound weak. But what he's saying is it's that steely, not showing of our emotions versus that natural tendency to show our emotions. And that sometimes causes perplexions within a marriage. I believe men tend to feel the same thing as women, but they don't come out and express it as well. We men tend to think that we need to hide that or keep it under wraps, keep ourselves under control. And I am very much that way, and I can appreciate how that probably is good at times. Women tend to build rapport by giving a report. And so communication for them is a way of building rapport, drawing closer. And often a wife will follow their husband around to give him a report of what's going on in that day. I started it. Guys ever come home from work and you want to go in the bedroom and change your clothes and you look around and she's right behind you? Well, that's okay, but you know, you're kind of thinking, well, okay, let me catch my breath here and get something cold to drink. We just need to understand that. But wives get frustrated. They'll ask us, how was your day? And we'll say, fine. What did you do? Nothing. Well, that doesn't give them information either. And it does develop a huge frustration. 85% of those who move toward their spouse to talk tend to be women. 85% of those who go poker face in conflict tend to be men. That is our natural tendency. And it can lead to a cycle of criticism and withholding. Men see stonewalling or poker face as trying not to react and stay cool. Women see it as hostility and pouting. And what happens if we're not careful is a rather vicious circle. The wife complains and criticizes, which makes the husband become more poker face and stonewall and quiet, which makes the wife complain and criticize more, which makes the husband become more poker face and criticize, and you just start chasing your tail. And if it weren't so serious, it would be funny. I believe a lot of marriages have suffered. One guy said, every time my wife and I get into our argument, my wife gets historical. Someone corrected him and said, you mean hysterical? He said, no, I mean historical. She brings up everything that seems unresolved. So, ladies, that might be something that you would want to watch. Well, I believe problems in our marriages will arise when we miss what God told us over 2,000 years ago, how to be good husbands and wives. So now I'm going back to Ephesians chapter 5. The key to cracking, whether it's the communication code or whatever needs to be cracked, is found here, I believe, in Ephesians chapter 5. Most of us are educated beyond our intelligence. And that leaves us often rather unwise. Love and respect, I believe, are the keys that Paul is giving us here in Ephesians chapter 5. I already read verse 25. Husbands, love your wives, even as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for it. But in verse 22, wives, submit yourselves to your husbands as unto the Lord. Verse 33, nevertheless, let every one of you in particular love his wife, even himself, and wife, see that she reverence or respect her husband. In those verses, I've got my two concepts that I believe Paul is giving me, love and respect. Well, the love term there is agape, and I believe most of you, I hope, have studied the various Greek words for love and know that agape is that deep spiritual love which says, I want what is best for that person. It is not an emotion. We should be emotional in our marriages, but that is not what Paul is talking about here. He's talking about selflessness and sacrifice. But when you look at verse 21 and 22, we have the word submit. The Greek word for submit is hupotasso. And it's often defined as subordinating or putting the husband first. And I don't argue with that, but I ran across another person explaining that word that I thought was good, so I wrote it down. He said, wives, when the Lord tells you to submit, what he is telling you, and I quote, is duck low enough so that God will touch your husband and your husband will touch God. I'm going to repeat that. When a wife is to submit, she is to duck low enough so that God can still touch the husband and the husband can touch God. In other words, ladies, don't get in the way of God and your husband having the interreaction and relationship that they must have for that man to lead your family well. And it is to be a pattern, not simply an occasional effort. Now, in verse 33, I believe we have a key verse. And it says, women, reverence in the King James, some translate that, respect your husband. The radical feminist movement does not like that verse. A feminist would say, if you don't have to respect him unless he has earned it. That is not what this scripture says. It does not say, wives, reverence your husband if they deserve it. It says, wives, reverence your husbands, period. Because he will often not deserve it. When we turn to 1 Peter chapter 3, and if time allows me, I will, it's talking about a woman being married to an unbelieving husband. Does he deserve, as an unbeliever, her reverence? Well, not in my way of thinking, but it is still a commandment. In fact, Peter says that's the way you ladies can win those husbands to the Lord. He doesn't say, wives, nag your husbands, and we know that won't work. He says, reverence them. In verse 2 of 1 Peter chapter 3, pardon me, he says, do it by your chaste, which is respectful, pure. I think the NIV says your pure and reverent behavior. You know, men look up to the honor code. That's why men are maybe more inclined to the military. When a man senses contempt or disrespect from his wife, he looks at it as a real affront on his manhood. Some of you might have seen, many of you have seen, it's on marathon at the holiday season, that movie Christmas Story. And there's a scene in there where they get this little boy to stick his tongue on a cold post outside the church, or outside the school, pardon me. And you know when you stick your tongue on a frozen, you're in trouble. And in order to get him, they say, I double dog dare you to do it. Well, when a guy hears that, he's going to do it. In general, that's the way men function. Men, since we are commanded to love our wives, that tells me our wives need to be loved. And if a wife, and she is commanded to reverence and respect her husband, it means, wives, your husbands need it. That is the way we are made. Women, before you speak, ask yourself, is that which I am about to say to my husband going to come across disrespectfully? Because if it is, it will wound him, and sometimes for a long, long time. Do I have that sour look, that expressive, responsive look on my face? In a marriage, a man without respect will respond by not giving love, and a woman without love will tend to respond without giving respect. And we're back to that vicious circle again. Wives can't function without love. Husbands can't function without respect. If we can get that through our heads, we'll begin to function the way I think Ephesians chapter 5 is telling us. Boys are blue, girls are pink. And when you mix blue and pink together, you get purple. In a marriage, we take the best of the man, the best of the woman, we put them together, and then we get the image of God. Because women have some attributes of God that we men don't naturally have, and vice versa. But also always remember that front side strengths always have backside weaknesses. The same thing, ladies, that will cause your husbands to be willing to die to protect you will also sometimes make them insensitive. And you're going to have to take sometimes the good with the bad. Men will serve and die if they have respect. Sometimes I'll hear a woman say when she's in the workplace, "I just love my boss." And she doesn't mean that romantically. But I don't ever hardly hear a man say that. Men will say, "I respect my boss." I've had a lot of bosses I respect, but I don't ever remember saying, "I love him." Because that wasn't a feeling that came upon me. Love and respect cause husbands and wives to move toward each other. Now, I'm not saying, and please don't take it, that I don't think men need love and I don't think women need respect. We do. We need them both. But the general tendency is for men to need that respect more. And some of you ladies are simply married to men that aren't as smart and as quick as you. Well, you should have seen that before you married them, so respect them. Some of you men are married with women that have trouble showing their respect. And respect is not always a verbal thing, ladies. It's often a facial expression. You ever been talking to a man and his wife was standing a little bit behind him and you could see by their shaking head or raised eyebrows, she's telling you, he just doesn't know what he's talking about. And she may be right. But don't do that to him. That is a demasculinization. So when I look at Ephesians chapter 5, and there's lots of verses, and we'll look at some more of them after I stop here after this prolonged introduction, which took almost the whole time. I think if we can just get the terms love and respect out of these verses, we've got the two pillars that I believe a marriage will succeed on if both parties will do that. We've got about 10 or 15 minutes before we break. I'm going to open it up for questions and comments. We've got a runner outside and a runner inside. So if you have something you would like to ask or say or share, I give you that opportunity now.
Hi, John. This is Kevin Morton.
Kevin Morton.
I haven't been married for very long. But
just a little louder, Kevin.
I said I haven't been married for very long, but one thing that I found helpful going into it is, you did mention something about warfare, and I think that there is an appropriate analogy there, but it's not warfare between the husband and wife. It's warfare of the marriage against Satan, against failure. The phrase that I had in my mind, I think it's important for us to have our mind going into it and keeping it in our mind, is failure is not an option. And you've covered that, but that phrase, simply put, just if you don't go into a marriage that way, and I appreciate that example that you cited, it's going to be an uphill battle. But keeping the idea of failure is not an option is good, I think.
Okay, I like that way of putting it. It's similar to saying, don't consider that marriage is terminable. You can end a marriage, but if we don't do it, well, that should never be our first option. Let me put it that way. There are some circumstances where marriages have had to end. I understand that. But I think even on what we might call the person that was wrong, they probably look back and wonder, well, maybe if I'd have done this a little different or that. But, you know, hindsight, isn't it wonderful? Let's try to approach these things with foresight. Anybody else care to make have a question or make? We got one over here and I'm one out there, so we'll get you, Joe.
This is Kimber Wright from Lawrence Congregation.
Real loud, Kimber.
This is Kimber Wright. Is that loud enough? One thing about in marriage and how children can maybe perceive that their parents had a perfect marriage, and then when they get married, they say, well, how come we're fighting? Our parents never fought. I think that there is a place for not only your children to see you disagree, but also make sure they see you make up.
Okay, if I got her comment, she said, the children are sometimes going to see you disagree, but also let them see that you've made up. So if they see you disagree, I agree. My preference is don't let them see that too often. Joe Dunn.
Joe Dunn from Carlinville. There's a couple things that I would like to make mention here. For all the young guys out there that haven't been married very long, this agape love that you're talking about there, it took me about 40 years to see that in my wife, and I wish now that I would have had what she had when we first got married. If I could have loved her like she loved me, there would have been a whole lot of things that would have been a whole lot easier in our marriage. But the thing that really makes it stick is God put us together. God kept us together. And when we said, until death do us part, we meant it. And with that, if you want to get any mileage out of your marriage, then you got to leave it to God, lean on God, look to God, and let him guide you in the way that you need to go. And love each other for all it's worth.
Thank you, Joe. I don't remember the exact statistics, and studies will vary, but it's somewhere around 70 to 75% of people get divorced 5 years later wish they hadn't. It's that old saying, the grass is usually not greener on the other side. It's often not even edible. We have anybody else that would care to make a comment or ask a question? Okay. For all you guys out there in the sun, it sure is cool in here. Okay. Let's go ahead and do a little bit more with Ephesians chapter 5. I don't know that I probably will not get through this before the break, but I would like to. What I want to discuss now is in this passage, I find what some might call the theology of marriage. You know, a lot of the marriage books and marriage seminars, and I've probably given some of those, and maybe I just gave some of those, are in the how-tos of marriage. And it's not inappropriate, and sometimes it's extremely what is needed, you know, how to do these things. And often counselors focus on happiness and how to be happy in your marriage, how to do this for your mate. But I believe Paul also in Ephesians chapter 5 focuses on the theology of marriage, and I believe the theology of marriage is holiness. If you look at verse 25, husbands, love your wives, even as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for it. Now, let's look at verses 26 and 27, which I believe he's telling me the theology of marriage. That he might sanctify and cleanse it with the washing of the water of the word, that he might present it to himself a glorious church, not having spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that it should be holy and without blemish. Now, he does make a little transition from our earthly marriages to the relationship of Christ to the church, but there is this element of holiness. I believe one of the problems that people have in marriage today is they focus on what I would call the idolatry of romance. We have made romance as a nation an idol, and we worship it. I do not believe romance is what Paul is talking about here. Now, romance has a place in marriage, but holiness is the driving factor, according to these verses. People today feel that the meaning in life comes when we find our soulmate. But biblical marriage calls for us as imperfect beings to marry another imperfect being. And therefore, our expectations of marriage often get crushed under its reality. We ask of marriage something that it was often not ever designed to give. Marriage is not designed to compete with God. Marriage is not designed to fill all or even our deepest needs. Marriage is designed to point us back to God and not away from God. Many times have you seen somebody get married and it results in them drifting away from God for a plethora of reasons? That is exactly the opposite of what Paul is talking about and what the Lord is telling us. We need to remember, and maybe ladies need to remember this a little bit more than we men, but I'm not sure of that. Our fullest fulfillment cannot be found in any man. And to all of you, I will say, your deepest fulfillment cannot be found in any horizontal relationship. It can only be found in a vertical relationship, and that's your relationship with God. The best husband here makes a terrible God. And the best wife here makes a terrible God. And they were never designed to be that. So don't expect for your husband and wife to fulfill your deepest needs, because they can't. If they could, you wouldn't need God. And if we try to have them do that, we're putting them in a position of competing with God, which is not what God had in mind when he designed marriage. We should not strive to become holy from our mates. We should strive to help our mates become holy. I want to repeat that. Don't ask your mates to make you holy, but strive to help them. Let them be all that God wants them to be. And if we were talking about how to choose a mate, I would say choose a mate that can help you become more holy. Because that's the great purpose, I believe, of marriage. When we act and live outside of holiness, we can and will quickly destroy our relationships. We are called to something so much bigger than meet my needs. Our marriages are to be very countercultural, because our culture says, I'm getting married to meet my needs. I don't want to be lonely anymore. I don't want to this. I don't want to that. I want to become that. That's need meeting. That's not what God designed. That may be the fruits of your marriage, but it's not the design of your marriage. And I think that's a lost message, even in the church. People view the church as something to meet their needs. Well, it will, but the purpose of the church is to glorify God. But we all know that people say, well, I just drifted away from church because I didn't feel like my needs were being met. I drifted away from marriage because I didn't feel my needs were being met. And we miss the theology of marriage, which I believe is holiness. No matter how wonderful our mates might be, when we look at them to be our gods, fulfilling all of our needs, we are going to fail every single time. So what do? We try other things. Let's build a new house. Let's have children. Well, those things can be wonderful, but they are no replacement for God. And we must recognize that we have needs and desires that no human being can ever meet. Okay, I've got a little bit more on that, but I'm going to go ahead and give you your break now, because I'd like to have some discussion on this, and if I go through my material, we won't have time for discussion, and you will have forgot what we talked about, so take your break. See you at 10:30.
Anyone interested in some sodas? We still have some sodas in the back of my truck up in the clearing there. Shane's on it.
Yeah. Otherwise, we're down to one. Test.
This is a test to see if the microphone will cut out.
Don't wait for your response.
Do you think that happened?
Huh?
Did that happen?